This episode of the Empowered Parent Podcast is brought to you by the Replanted Conference. Replanted provides a time away for caregivers to be refreshed, equipped, and inspired. To register, visit replantedconference.org. You're listening to the Empowered Parent Podcast with Ryan and Kayla North, hosted by Chris Turner, a One Big Happy Home production. This podcast equips parents to empower their children and build healthy relationships throughout the home in order to see lasting change and thrive as a family. It's for families of all kinds, especially those who are parenting kids through adoption, foster care, kinship care, or in the process. The Empowered Parent Podcast is a developmentally informed, trauma-sensitive, connected parenting resource. To learn more, visit onebighappyhome.com.
Greetings and welcome to another episode of the Empowered Parent Podcast. Joining me once again are Ryan and Kayla Dora.
Hey guys. Chris.
Hello, Christopher. You know my favorite thing about you changing it up is every time you do it, Kayla's face like lights up with a smile. Like I don't know why that's so amusing to her. But the next episode, I'm sitting with my phone over here by my microphone.
Just so you can see my face.
No, so I can post a video of you. People deserve to delight in your delight as I do, my dear.
Delight in my delight. Okay. Well,
clearly that's delightful to you because it is a big old... You know when you smile so big your eyes close? That's how big she was smiling when you said, join maybe this time.
Maybe it's just because he's introducing us and it's like taking the stage. But No.
That would be inconsistent with your joy in taking
this. That's true. I don't have a lot of joy in taking the stage.
You're like, it's showtime. She's like, okay, let's do it.
I'm like, ooh, take some deep breaths.
For real.
So do you have
So if you don't mind, Chris.
Sure.
Like even like when we were last weekend, you still like took a couple of deep breaths.
Yeah, I have to ground myself a little bit, like center myself, because that's... Okay. Yeah, me
that's
being
a little
on the
surprising
stage.
To me, because she was king of that, the master of that domain on Saturday, man. I was like, wow, I've not seen that level of just like public speaking confidence out of kid. I told her that too. It was just so great to see. So I'm a little surprised to say that you had to take a couple
of years. I have to. Anytime I get on a stage, it's because I always have this little bit of a fear that
That was my question.
I have this. I like to be liked. Like that's something about me. Mm. I want people to like me. But I'm not
Chris
afraid.
Chris says as he learns this for the first time ever. No.
Well, and I'm not afraid. Like I used to be afraid, like, you know, a little bit of this, like, oh no, they're not going to like me. So I'm going to have to like pretend a little bit, you know, a little bit of that. Like we talked in the last episode about that, like fawn response. I think I had a little bit of that, but because I didn't want to conflict. Now I'll be straightforward with people for sure. But I do every time we like are speaking to a group, I think, are they just going to laugh at me and think that the things I'm saying are stupid? Like, how receptive are they going to be? And then once I get a couple of head nods or I get a couple of like, you can tell that people are like, oh, this makes sense. Then I'm like, okay. And I feel like I'm calm and I'm not afraid the rest of the time. I'm totally fine. But that initial moment, if it's a group that I'm speaking in front of all the time or a mom's group or something like that, that doesn't bother me. But if it's new people, I'm always kind of a little bit like...
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, right? The stranger element, because I said on Friday night, how many of you knew anything about... No, on Saturday to the churches. Mm-hmm. How many of you knew anything about us before you came in this morning? And nobody raised their hand. Mm. So now I realize in retrospect that probably was not very helpful.
Because if we go into a crowd...
Also like, why is there Lamar's breathing coming through the PA?
Well, because if we go into a group and you know, you ask that question and half of them are like podcast listeners, then I feel like, okay, they already know me. Like they feel comfortable with me. But if it's a totally new group who's like, why did my, you know, boss make me go here? You know, I remember one time we spoke in a school district. And there were some people that were very receptive to what we had to say, but you could tell there was like this one table in the back of like all the coaches who were like, this is mumbo jumbo. Mm. They were totally checked out. And I found myself the whole time like trying to like talk to them, like, please pick up on something. Mm. You need to hear this, you know? Mm-hmm. But it wasn't fear at that point. It was like,
a little anger.
They need to know this. Yeah. Your body language tells me that you're not treating the kids the way they need to be treated in your classroom, you know. But at the beginning of it, it's always a little bit of a fear for me.
It's so, funny. Oh, sorry.
To peel back the layer there, Kayla, why do you think you have a fear of public speaking?
Because I'm human.
what was it that Seinfeld said he read?
He said the
number two fears were public speaking and death, which means you'd rather be the person in the casket than the one delivering the eulogy.
Correct.
Brother, that Seinfeld joke is based on research. Right.
It's
called glossophobia. More people are afraid of public speaking, adult Americans, than the dentist, dying, flying, name it, like almost anything else. Oh. It always charts as a fear.
And I don't know, I can't name anything, like I can't think of anything, like, and I never had a bad experience with public, I mean, I took a speech class, communications class in college, and I had to get up and give a speech, and, you know, I did a little bit of, like, theater stuff when I was in elementary school, and I was, you know, I never had a fear, like, I don't remember ever having a fear. I don't know why.
I think you've already explained it though.
Yeah.
Because
it's the liking thing.
Yeah. Because
it's the people.
It's the Mick Jagger thing. Like Mick Jagger says he still gets stage fright. Mm. Watching a documentary and then the guy said, like, you've likely performed to
millions,
like hundreds of millions of people in your career.
Easily tens of millions. Yeah.
And he says, I have the same compelling thought standing on the side of the stage every single night when they play the intro music. Will they like me tonight?
Mm-hmm.
Mick Jagger. Elvis Presley famously had stage fright.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're in pretty good company in that regard. But I think the thing is, because it's like, I don't want to, because we rank it, right? Like, so you're afraid of public speaking because people say, well, I might come up and people might not take me seriously. They might think I don't know what I'm talking about. They might get up and walk out. Like, to me, that's the only thing. They might laugh at me. They might not like me.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, those are all the things, and those are really, really very real.
Well, I taught, you know, third grade, and I would get a new class of kids every year, but eight-year-olds like their teacher. Like, it's just
a given.
They
still want to give them hugs.
Yeah. It's a given. They're, like, excited for the first day of school, and they hug their teacher, and they bring you a gift, and they love you. And then, you know, you are mean to them, and then they don't love you anymore. But, you know, on the first day of school, they all love you, right? But if you, you know, there are things that will make you them not love you and think you're amazing, but... But I always got more nervous for parent-teacher conferences and for orientation, because I would do an orientation with the families like the week before.
Yeah.
And I would tell the parents, I'd be like, I just want you to know, I'd rather you be a room full of eight-year-olds. I don't like talking to parents. And now here I am, ironically, you know, that's my job now, is talking to parents. And
you're great.
To be quite honest, it's kind of flipped. Like, don't give me a room full of eight-year-olds. I would be a little more fearful of a room full of eight-year-olds point.
Oh, my gosh. I think we need to do, because we have to get back to it.
Yeah, we do.
We do. But I think what we should do is just not have an episode. We don't plan anything. And then somebody just start talking. And
talk about random stuff.
Yeah, because I think this is very insightful into who you are.
Yeah.
You know, like when I get up there, I realize that I have like zero anxiety about it. Like the only anxiety I have about it is at 5 to 9. I'm like, can 9 o'clock get here faster so they can introduce us and we can go up there, right? But I realize it's not born out of like a real confidence in my abilities or any of those kinds of things. I think those have developed over time. But when I started doing it, it's when I realized, like, I was nervous the first like conference I spoke at a main stage. I remember being just like really like, oh my gosh, and like I had like handwritten notes and stuff. I had to make sure I got it said. And then I got up there, and by the time I was done, there was this real calmness over me, because it occurred to me, the house I grew up in was, I brought you into this world, I can take you out of it, children be seen, not heard, you know, all the stuff you could have finished the sentences. And so I didn't get to get all my words out.
Mm.
I was shut down pretty quickly. Dissent was not allowed. But here I am at the microphone and nobody's interrupting. It was like, I'm like, I realized in that moment that the public speaking is some version of the redemption of 7-year-old Ryan.
Mm.
And I think that's why I like it so much, because I'm like, no, I get to be heard.
Mm-hmm.
Which people who hear us speak may go, oh my gosh, he's adorable for somebody his size with that gruff look on his face. But I do that the same thing you do. like the first person who nods at something I say,
I tend to
focus on them for a while until the whole thing kind of settles in, like almost like until we get past the clouds.
Yeah, sure.
So it's funny you mentioned 7-year-old Ryan, because when Kayla was talking about, you know, her stage experience, the thing that occurred to me was, when you guys asked me to host Tapestry Conference a few years back, I might have been a little more nervous than maybe I wasn't, just because, you know, when you're in a room with 7-year-olds and you're singing about squishing up the little baby bumblebee, and you've got their big macho dads singing along with you and doing all the little hand motions, you can kind of just get over fears of public speaking at that point, because, yeah. Talking to a room full of people who want to be there? Oh, sure. That's not a problem at all.
Yeah. That's awesome. All right. You asked a question at the end of the last one.
Okay, yeah. And I don't remember how exactly I worded it.
I memorized it because I hang on every word you say, baby.
Do you hang on every word I say? Chris had to, like, sit back from his mic, like, 6 feet as he laughed at
that. As loud as that's going to be in your ears, Chris is, like, legitimately 4 feet back from his microphone.
With my head raised in the air.
Oh, my goodness gracious. He does hang on every word.
Would you like
me
to rephrase it?
No, I can. Okay. I can say it.
Because I can prove that I remember.
I know you do, baby. You pay attention. No, I was just talking about, you know, like,
I thought Chris was going to say we need to quit flirting with each other.
Look at a real point.
No, as parents, I think we respond to our kids' behaviors oftentimes out of fear.
Yep.
I remember a mom coming to me once, this has been years ago, probably 10 years ago. And she came up to me and she said, I need you to help me figure out how to get my kid to stop stealing stuff, because he's going to end up in jail before he gets out of high school. And I said, tell me how old your kid is. And she said, he's 6. And I was like, okay, I get that he's 6. I said, he's little, you know, and we're going off this like half your chronological age. So he's like a 3-year-old who's going into the store and he's taking stuff. And I get it. It's frustrating. And they get to school and they start bringing home random stuff and you don't know where it came from. And
my friend gave it to me.
Yeah.
It's not just frustrating them. It's embarrassing.
It's embarrassing. Mm-hmm.
That's what triggers the parents.
Yes. And that is exactly right. It's embarrassing. Parents don't know exactly how to handle it. And so they just want the behavior to stop. But also they start thinking to the future. They've seen movies. They've watched their friends' kids. They've seen siblings or cousins or whoever.
And they always go to the worst case scenario.
Yes. They find somebody who they're like, oh my gosh, my kid's going to end up like so-and-so. And then they have these over-the-top responses that are going to quote unquote squash the behavior so that it'll never happen again. But it doesn't squash the behavior. It just makes the kid get better at hiding the behavior.
Yeah, right.
Or it escalates the behavior to the next level of like, oh yeah, well, let me show you how I can do this.
And ultimately you could create an environment where it becomes the prophecy gets fulfilled.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Right.
Correct.
Prophecy. Right. Yeah. So,
yes,
you know, to talk about, Well, like we tend to overreact because from a place of fear, right? And then so we catastrophize the behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the reasons you catastrophize the behavior is because then your big response is justified in your own mind, because you're not trying to get your kid from quitting. You don't want your 7-year-old to stop taking granola bars without your permission. You're trying to keep him out of jail,
mm-hmm.
yeah. right? I mean, that's a different response,
right?
And so one of the things always tell us whenever we get to talk to parents who have raised their hand and said, we want to become foster parents, in any kind of training before they get licensed, I always tell them, please, if your child takes food out of the pantry without your permission, it's not stealing. I can explain how it's not stealing. You bought the food for the consumption of the individuals living in your home, which means that there is the child can't steal. But stealing's a crime. It's not just a word.
Mm-hmm.
It's an actual crime. And the problem with that is once you start using criminal words to describe your child, you will start viewing your child as a criminal. And then you'll start treating your child as a criminal. And then once you start treating your child as a criminal, good luck having a good relationship with your child.
Mm-hmm.
Because we know that change in the context of family is born out of relationships, right? You feel safe, relationships grow. Where relationships grow, behaviors change because children heal. And so what happens is when we catastrophize, and so that's why we have to learn about regulating responses. And we have to, like I teased you about your doing Lamaze breathing earlier. We have to learn these things. We have to learn what works for us. Because in the moment, you have to avoid the catastrophizing of the child's behavior. Or if you do it, you have to walk it back.
And we
think, well, you got to stand your ground. And I'm a person of integrity. We don't change. That sounds great somewhere, I guess. But if you've overreacted, the person of integrity will go and walk it back. Mm-hmm. They won't just go, well, no, I've said it. Now I can't change my mind. They'll know they can't take me seriously. Well, I'd rather have my kids learn that when I overreact, I'm humble enough to walk it back than have them learn that he just folds his arms. And because you know what they're going to do? They're just going to fold their arms and stand their ground too.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this is also a great time to get to the why behind the behavior, right? Like, why is the kid stealing food?
Taking without permission. I'm just having fun. Don't throw things.
Right. So obviously they're not doing it just because.
Right.
I mean, they might in some cases because that's what children do. Like they do things just because they want to see what happens, right?
I mean, a 14-year-old boy who's just hungry all the time.
Right.
I mean, we've passed that stage with two boys and they are like ravenous locusts.
Yes.
Yes.
Like we would have nicer furniture if we didn't have teenage boys. Like, you have no idea how much
food
Costco et al. Get out of us every month.
Yep.
Well, and that's the problem is that if we respond out of fear, we can't be curious about the behavior.
Oh, that's good.
Mm-hmm. So if we're fearful that they're going to end up in jail, then we respond as someone preventing their kid from ending up in jail.
Right.
But if we respond as a curious parent who's saying, why are they doing this? Like, what's going on behind this? Why does my kid keep bringing home electronic devices from school that don't belong to them? Why does my child continue to, you know, what X, Y, Z? Like, fill in the blank with whatever behavior they're doing that we're convinced this behavior is going to, like, come back at them later on in life, right? We're convinced that because they did this behavior, they will never be, you know, they will never get the job you think they're going to get, or they're never going to, you know, end up doing, like we...
Or get the job you think they should get.
Yeah. Yes.
The fear, I think, is... I think the ultimate fear, yes, doubt the catastrophizing that you alluded to earlier, Ryan, of if they don't stop taking stuff without permission, they're going to end up in jail. Mm-hmm. That's the ultimate fear. I think the more immediate fear is it's a compounding effect.
Right. If I don't stop it now,
is he just going to keep doing it rather than thinking to yourself, he will grow out of certain behaviors, right? Like that's what kids naturally do.
Right.
They're going to grow out of certain things as they age and develop and that sort of thing. And I think we forget about that middle part. We forget about the developmental and growing out of it stage, and that's why we leap to that ultimate conclusion that isn't necessarily true.
Yes. Well, we had a kiddo who, like, she sucked on her hand, like, for a long time. Like
all four fingers.
Like, all four fingers, not her thumb, like, the whole thing in her hand, and it was, like, the craziest thing you've ever seen. And I remember talking to the pediatrician one time, and I was like, I was a little afraid, like, if I didn't do something about it, that she was going to always suck on her hand. And I will tell you, she's a teenager now that does not suck on her hand. And we didn't do anything about it.
Yeah.
But there was a little bit of that fear of like, I mean, she's like 4 years old. And the pediatrician was like, she'll find a new habit, like picking her nose. It's fine.
Well, because
and he was trying
he was
to be
a wise
funny,
old pediatrician, though.
But yeah, I mean, he knew.
He knew what we didn't.
Yes, he knew what we
didn't. The first day of kindergarten. The first kid that said something about her sucking on her four fingers, she's done.
Yes.
Right? I mean, one of the best parenting books ever, Freakonomics. I tell people this all the time. There's a whole chapter on parenting in it.
Yeah.
And they talk about how we need to just come to terms with that we can be, quote, the best parents ever. We can read to our kids, teach them their number, shapes, colors early on, and teach them a second language, take them to church every time the doors open, whatever. Mm. But all of that's undone by recess on the second day of kindergarten. Because the most influential people in your children's lives are their peers.
Yeah.
Right? And so we have to, but because I think we all subconsciously know that, but we're afraid that that's true because I can't control for how other people parent their children.
Mm-hmm.
Right? is why we try to just kind of have this really controlling environment mm-hmm. in our homes. Now, the other thing, and I wanted to say this earlier, the other thing is that for a lot of us, we go, oh my gosh, we have to nip this in the bud now because John, I don't know why Johnny is always the example I use, but because Johnny's going to end up in jail when he's 20.
Yeah.
All of us parents, for me, I forgot all the stuff I did as a child, as a teen. And the most recent weekend in my life, I spent it on a stage in a church with a microphone in my head, telling them about what relationships are important to Jesus. Mm. I didn't end up in jail. I ended up on a church stage speaking to people who have devoted their lives to ministering to children. Right, we tend to forget that we didn't end up in jail.
Yeah.
The first record I ever bought for myself was Born in the USA by Bruce Springsteen, 85 or whenever that came out.
Sounds about right, something like that, yeah.
Partially with money that I'd earned from chores, and I put myself over the finish line by nicking a few bucks from my mother's purse. I didn't end up in jail. I stole money from my mother's purse. Right? We just have to remember that. We just have to remember that none of these prophecies were true in our own lives. Mm. I'm not going to ask you guys to fess up to anything bad you did, because, I mean, there might be, like, no statute of limitations on some of your stuff, Chris. Kayla may have to confess to, you know, raising a voice to her mother once. I mean, I don't know what...
I stole a pack of gum out of the grocery store.
I baited you right into that.
I did.
So
I totally took a pack of gum and...
I could beat that, but we're not going to talk about it all.
Because he just remembered, he does not know what the statute of limitations are for his particular crime. But all the point I'm trying to make is we forget that we didn't end up in the bad places that likely some of the adults in our lives thought we were going to end up.
Yeah.
And I understand that if your child has a trauma history, it's slightly more complicated, and because we're so hypervigilant, because, you know, fear tends to be an outcome of hypervigilance.
Right.
And we have to accept that we're hypervigilant because we go, okay, so this part of my child's history I don't know.
Yeah.
This part of the thing, like I don't know what some of the inputs into this child's life with the first 4 years, 6 years, 8 years, whatever, however old they were going to come, mm-hmm. come to your home. And so you don't know. And so it's easy. Like I don't want people listening to go, oh, they're kind of making fun of folks who catastrophize behaviors. Because it's easy to do it because you're like, there's just so many unknowns.
Well, and especially...
We're not making fun of it because we've all done it.
Yeah.
Well,
unknown drives fear, right?
Right.
Well, or if there are knowns, like if there's known mental illness in the family, that all of a sudden...
Well, if you know the child was the trained thief for the family, for resources, like Perry talks about in Born for Love, the kids were committing crimes on behalf of the family because they were underage.
Well, I was just thinking like mental illness, and like if you know, like let's say you have a kid who has a family history of some kind of mental illness, schizophrenia, bipolar, or something along those lines that you know, you're like, oh, they could have this. Like, and so you're constantly watching for signs and things that might be, you know, just some trauma responses or might be just, you know, a kid that's struggling. We end up going, oh my gosh, they're going to be bipolar. Did you see that? What happened there?
It's one thing, right?
Yeah. And then you've just decided that's, and we have to kind of go, okay, you know, like I know, you know, fear, there's always fear that, you know, when you know something and then you think, oh gosh, this could happen to my kid. Or same thing with family history. If you've got a family history of heart disease, then you're constantly on the lookout for it. And some people are so afraid that every time, you know, something feels slightly off, they're like, oh, it must be, you know, they've decided with medical things, right? And so we do it with our kids if we have any information. And then the problem is parenting out of fear doesn't allow us the opportunity to see who's in front of us. Mm-hmm. We're only looking at the future and what might be. And we miss this kid in front of us that needs us to parent them right where they are and right in that space. Mm-hmm. But we miss out on that.
You said something on Saturday, and I actually mentioned it in front of the group who we were training, because I'd never heard a phrase like this before. And she said, when you see a behavior in your child, instead of choosing to see it as defiant or difficult, because if you see it as defiant or difficult, your response will be to get it under control.
Mm-hmm.
Or as I like to say, crush the rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a Star Wars fan. Darth Vader is my favorite. But if you tend to, if you ask, don't say this is difficult or defiant, you see it as, well, that's a fear-driven behavior. If you choose to see it as a fear-driven behavior, your response has a better chance of being compassionate. We're not guaranteeing that every time it'll be compassionate, but you at least have a chance of being compassionate. When you see it as difficult or defiant or whatever negative term you want to use, your response has very little chance of actually being compassionate, being curious, all the things we've talked about over here, because we can only see the future, and the future's bleak, and we believe if we just get it under control now, well, you know, we were raised by people who were raised by people who were raised by people who did that, right?
Right.
Because the stakes for non-compliance generations ago
was much higher.
Was much higher than it is today.
Yep.
Yeah.
But we've not adjusted our need for compliance as parents.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and I think, you know, one other thing that I kind of thought about on the lines of fear is we have to replace the fear with what is true. And this is something that I tell, you know, we have one of our kiddos who's pretty anxious and has a lot of fears of, you know, I mean, like, I have to take all my stuffed animals with me because the house might burn down when we leave, or I can't, you know, I can't leave this behind because this might happen. And a lot of those scenarios, and we're constantly saying, what is true? Like, what about the situation is true? What do you know, you know, to be true in whatever, you know, oh, nobody's going to like me, you know, I'm afraid nobody's going to like me when I go, so I'd rather not go. Well, what is true? Well, I know there's going to be people there. Do you know those people? Yes. Okay, that's what you know to be true. You don't know to be true that they're not going to like you. But if you go into the situation thinking they're not going to like you, then you're going to perceive everything they do through that lens of them not liking you. Well, and that's what fear does to you. It just distorts everything.
Yeah, I mean, anxious people struggle to believe that people like them, right? I mean, we know that, right? And so I will tell you that part of what we've done at home is consistently done this. What do you know to be true? Okay. What are you actually afraid of? Like, what are you afraid is going to happen? And not dealing with the anxiety that we're seeing, but kind of grounding her, centering her with the what do you know to be true. And once we get a little bit towards that, we can start saying, okay, now what's really bothering you? And that child today has less anxiety because we did that for years. Yeah. She has less anxiety. She travels without the entourage anymore. She doesn't even stress out about the entourage anymore. Yeah. Her test scores have gone up at school.
Yeah.
And she did standardized testing, and Kayla got feedback, and they said, this is a huge jump over last year. And Kayla looked at me and said, no, it's just because she's less stressed about it.
Yeah.
Right, because you can get your children to a place where they're functioning in a more calm way, when their behaviors aren't driven by fear, but you got to do the work.
Well, and you can do the same with yourself, too.
Well, I was just saying, but part of doing the work is doing it with yourself, is what I was going to say.
Yeah.
And I think part of doing the work, I'd like to phrase that differently, I'd say the prerequisite to doing that work with your children is doing the work with yourself.
Because if you're parenting out of fear, then they're going to see your fear.
Yeah, they sense
and
it.
And they're going to respond out of fear.
Well, it was like that time we flew to England years ago, before we had kids. This is because Kayla wanted to be a mom from the moment they handed her to her mother. She's like, I want to be that. So her whole life she's wanted to be a mom. And then we got married and I'm like, man, we gotta not have kids for like 2 years, and so I planted this.
Do a couple things,
yeah.
Like I planted this. I said, let's go visit South Africa, where I was born, and so about 2.5 years into our marriage,
and it's gonna take a long time to plan it.
and hey, we were poor newlyweds in our 20s.
We had to save.
Time to pay for it too, and so we go out to South Africa, and I forgot why I started telling the story. Oh my gosh, I hate that when that happens. Okay. Anyway.
Fear
driving your behavior. We have to do it for ourselves too.
Lost your train of thought.
My train of thought.
That's okay. Because I have a train of thought.
Okay, go.
On what both of you were saying earlier, I think the thing that we forget as parents of is why we're fearful of these things. And it all goes back to expectations. We always have expectations, right? And some of them are valid expectations.
Yep.
Right.
And then some of them maybe not so much. And we don't even realize sometimes we have these expectations. You know, my child is doing poorly in school. Oh my God, they're not going to go to college. They're not going to get a good job. That's an expectation that you have.
Right.
That they are going to do well in school. They are going to go to college. They are going to get a good job. It's just not, you haven't realized that it's an expectation you hold.
Yeah, I mean, expectations are good.
And so that expectation, when it's not being met, generates a fear response. And then that's how you end up reacting to your kid not doing well in school.
Yeah, which is unlikely to help them do better.
Right.
I remember why I said that.
Okay.
And so we flew from Dallas to London and then London to Johannesburg to get to South Africa. And the flight out of Dallas, for those of you who have never used DFW Airport in the summer, taking off from DFW Airport in the summer is a kind of a miserable experience because it's unbelievably hot in the afternoon. And then you got all these different thermals, the temperatures off of the grass, the concrete, the asphalt, the glass, and all the different surfaces you're constantly flying over. It's just kind of bumpy getting out of DFW in the summertime. And so this predates me figuring out why I was afraid of flying. I was like terrified of flying. Like I'm squeezing Kayla's hand, perspiring on the jet. Like we're taxiing, and so we're sitting at the bulkhead on the 777, and the flight attendant is buckled in and facing us. And so she sees my distress and starts talking to me, and she says, "I used to be terribly afraid of flying." Because she's British Airways, she goes, "Oh, I used to be terribly afraid of flying." She's much better sounding than I am, and I said to her, "Interesting career choice," and she said, "Yeah." But what I realized is we flew to the Caribbean when I was a child, and my mother was terrified. And I just thought, that's what you're supposed to do on airplanes. Mm. Like she saw her mom, and she said, well, that's what you're supposed to act like. And so she said, until I made sense of that and realized that I had just taken on my mother's fear as my own, I couldn't get on an airplane. I used to be terrified too. And at the time, I don't know obviously what she does now 20 years later, but at the time, she was earning her living as a flight attendant and an international flight attendant for British Airways. And so I thought about that story when you talk about our children see our fear and they don't just latch onto it in the moment. It also plants the seed that this is how they're supposed to act. And when you operate out of fear, you miss so much of the goodness of life.
Yeah.
So much of the goodness of life. We could have traveled more before we had kids. But primarily it didn't happen because of my fear of being on airplanes. Missed out on like a bunch of great opportunities that we're going to have to go back on when, you know, when my youngest goes off to college or something, right? And then, I don't know. I mean, I won't be as young and be able to run up the stairs like I could back then. And so I think we missed out on some of that because of my fear. My behavior was driven by fear. And, and what happens is we miss out on some of the goodness relationally with our children when it's driven by fear too. So.
Well, because relationship is really going to be what helps your kids in the long run. Like the things you're afraid of. So, you know, I had a therapist one time that said to me, she was like, so what are you afraid of in a situation? Mm-hmm. And she said, what are you afraid is going to happen? And I told her and she goes, so what if that does happen? Then what?
That's a good question.
And I was like, well, then, you know, this or this. And she goes, and how are you going to handle that? Like, what are you going to do if that happens? Like, so just play it out. Your worst case scenario comes true. Your kid goes to jail. Then what? All you've got is your relationship with your kid at that point.
Yep.
You're going to have a conversation with them. You're going to have to go visit them in jail. Like, okay, what are you afraid of? Oh, your friends are going to talk about you? Well, they're not really your friends. You know?
Well, we're back to the
being embarrassed.
The shame.
Embarrassed. You're shame, right? And you'll nail it down if you kind of ask yourself that question of, okay, so what if that does happen? Like, what if your greatest fear comes true? Then what? And I was like, oh. Because, I mean, I was like sobbing on the couch in her office. Like, she's like, tell me what you're really afraid of.
How did she pick up what you were talking about?
It was pretty hard.
She's a really good therapist.
She's experienced.
Very, very experienced.
Kayla's not the first mom who cried on her couch.
Right. And she's just like, tell me, what are you really afraid of?
It's a great question.
And that it really brought a lot of like clarity for me when I sat and thought about what was I really afraid of? Like, why was this upsetting me so much? And why was I responding in such a big way? And what if it actually happened? And I was like, oh, she's like, you're going to deal with it. If it happens, you're going to deal with it. You know, it might happen.
And this just goes back to something we've said since the beginning of the podcast, really, is you got to do the homework on yourself.
For sure.
So you can do the homework on your kids.
Yeah. Yeah. That's where you have to start. You have to know yourself so well and understand it for yourself truly in order to help your kids.
Well, we compare this to athletes a lot, right? Or anything, right? Before an athlete gets to achieve the highest level of their sport, there's years of preparation. Mm-hmm. There's training. The best players in the world still have coaches. They mm-hmm. still take instruction. Mm-hmm. That's why they succeed, because they have the growth mindset. Musicians, too. You don't just pick up a guitar and end up playing guitar in like a Grammy award-winning band. Mm-hmm. It's years and years of faithful practice and sacrifice and dedication. And it's like the Jordan Peterson thing I heard him say one time. He said, things are hard, but doing hard things are worth it. Because at the end, the sacrifice you had to make and the effort you had to expend is worth it. You just can't see it on this side.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We all accept that. But when it comes to parenting, we're just like, I'm going to be great at it because I had parents. Mm-hmm. Right? And we do that, though. But think of it like as a professional athlete, we always have a preseason to get them into game shape, right? Mm-hmm. Well, think about doing the work and understanding yourself as sort of your preseason for parenting. And so for all of us, we've had to do that kind of during the season. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But if you're listening to this and you are considering becoming a parent, oh my gosh, give yourself a huge advantage here and start figuring out. The reason you don't do it is because there are no kids that trigger your baggage, right?
Go borrow some children. Go work with children.
Go borrow some children.
Surely you have friends with children.
Go to a family reunion.
A family reunion, yeah, there you go.
That feels like a mic drop moment, Chris.
Yeah, it probably is a good place to stop. Because I'm sure for some of our listeners, the words family reunion are triggering all sorts of fear.
Some of your participants.
Oh, goodness.
Well, as always, thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Empowered Parent Podcast. If you have any questions or topics you'd like us to discuss in the podcast, you can email us at podcast.onebighappyhome.com. Please like and share the podcast with your friends and family, and you can find us on your favorite social platforms by searching for One Big Happy Home. And for our supporters, don't go anywhere. We have a special Green Room episode right after this. Again, if you'd like to become a supporter, you can visit podcast.onebighappyhome.com. Thanks for listening.